to the second case for today, which is United States versus Knight et al. Mr. Flynn?
Good morning, please the court, opposing counsel. Your Honor, I'm here to argue the briefs on behalf of the consolidated brief for all defendants. I'm going to rest on the individual brief for Mr. Williams unless this court has any questions or wants to address any of those issues. I just would like to bring up one clarification. In its response to Mr. Williams' individual brief, they indicate that the statutory maximum is not raised by the filing of the information that there was a previous conviction for Mr. Williams. That's not entirely true. That depends on what weight is attributed to it. The statute has different statutory maximums, 20 years, 40 years, and life. In the case of 20 years, if they did not find the requisite quantity, the statutory maximum is raised to 30 years. In the case of a 40-year statutory maximum, if it's raised to life, and obviously if it's life, it's not raised. So I just wanted to clarify that because all three defendants were sentenced to a mandatory life sentence under the guidelines based on the findings of the court as opposed to the jury. I'd like to start the analysis by pointing out that I believe in this circuit, although I'm not familiar with what's currently on your docket and has not yet been decided, this is a case of first impression where specifically a jury instruction was requested that the jury make the determination as to the individual amounts of drugs attributable to each defendant, and it was denied. The government, in requesting the denial, and the court in relying on the case law on which they based their denial, relied essentially on pre-Apprendi case law, which has been clarified even more recently in the very recent United States Supreme Court decision, Ring. It is now clear, the court has said over and over again, that if a case, or if a fact, increases the statutory maximum, as it does in this case, and in fact, in the case of Knight, Williams, and Newton, placed them in a mandatory range where the judge really had no discretion to give anything other than life, that must be put to the jury. That did not happen here. In here, the jury instructions clearly given to the jury asked them simply to find that a conspiracy exists and that these people become a part of that conspiracy. As to the different members, there are different arguments that can be made, but as to count one, that clearly, when the government argues that the evidence is overwhelming, that simply isn't supported in the record. There's so much controversy surrounding, and the witnesses that testified changed their testimony over and over again, including Laura Collins, at whose home the drugs were found, the bodies were found, the money was found, at the trial, saying that the only amount of cocaine brought to her house that night was 1 kilo of cocaine. In previous testimony, she had said it was 5 kilos. She also changed the identity of the person bringing it on at least 3 occasions. That is not overwhelming evidence. That invades the province of the jury to pick and choose what version of the truth the government's witnesses have given, either in different trials under oath or different times to the government in an attempt to please the government for sentence reductions. These are factual matters that cannot simply take the facts most favorable to your position and say it's overwhelming evidence. The night of October 22nd, 1996 has been the subject of many litigations, and to this day, I don't think the government still knows who shot Frank McCray and whose dope it was. We do know that there was a house that was shared in the upstairs neighbor was a multi-kilo drug dealer. There's a common basement that connected the two residences. He's been the subject of litigation, separate preceding cases that have gone up through the Seventh Circuit. We know Laura Collins' boyfriend, who was incarcerated, Carl McAfee, was deeply involved in cocaine. He could move that kind of quantity, had stash houses. We learned later at sentencing, and that will get into the Brady portion of this argument, that according at least to Carl McAfee's nephew, Jimmy McAfee, Laura Collins ran his drug deal and his stash houses while he was incarcerated, and was not the small-time bit player she pretended to be, seeking originally an ounce of cocaine and ultimately a kilo, but in fact managed his business while he was in prison. And that was a part of the bulwark of the defense in this case. As to all three defendants, given the fact that the jury never determined the amount of drugs attributable to each one of them, but only determined that there was a conspiracy, and that somewhere in the context of this entire conspiracy, there was more than the requisite 5 kilos involved, we asked that the case be sent back for a new trial with the proper jury instructions. In the alternative, we asked, because there has been no determination, that a default, and there clearly was cocaine involved, powder cocaine, we asked that a default maximum of 20 years be imposed. The Brady issue is also troublesome, and it's not one that we raise lightly, and I can tell this court, I've been a criminal defense attorney for 16 years, 10 in the federal courts, I've never really seen a case prosecuted like this. And I don't mean to cast aspersions on anyone. Frankly, I think the government does not have confidence, and it's borne out in the record in what was presented at trial.
Well, Mr. Flynn, although much of the evidence was provided late, excuse me, for the most part, weren't you still able to use it in cross-examination and in the presentation of your defense?
No, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. It was a complex case in which the government promised, essentially what they ended up putting in front of the jury is about half of what they promised, what they gave us in discovery, and what they told the jury they were going to be putting on in their opening statement. And we're attempting to analyze all this in relationship of one witness to another, because there's a great deal of impeachment material that some of these witnesses were provided to others.
Well, I mean, do you think that you've pointed out with specificity how the earlier tender of that evidence would have altered your use of it to such an extent as to call, you know, the outcome of the case into question?
Well,
I didn't see it.
A good example of that type of evidence, Your Honor, would be the gun casings being traced back in the gun to this individual, Danny, whose last name I escaped me at the moment. Had we known this information not days into the trial, we could have made a concerted effort to go out and try and find this man and say, where did you get the gun? You know, if you weren't there that night, where did it come from? Furthermore, the fact that Orlando Williams, who was convicted for purchasing a kilo of that cocaine that night, tells Agent Planbeck, the case agent, the lead agent in this case, that Marcus Adams was there, which is the government's main corroborating witness against my client, Troy Williams, that is totally something we didn't even find that out until sentencing. If Marcus Adams is there, given his testimony that he was afraid of a great switcheroo, and those are his words, that there's going to be an identity switch, that people are going to be placed there that night who weren't there, and he was concerned that it was going to be him, the fact that if someone told them he was there that night, and the chief case agent knew that, and he never took the stand, had we known that, we would approach that radically different. And I don't know why.
When you say radically different, can you be a little more specific?
My cross-examination of Marcus Adams would have concentrated heavily on the fact that he was there that night. I would have sought out Orlando Williams, brought him in, had an investigator talk to him. If he was there that night, what was he doing? What did you see him doing? If he was there that night, he lied under oath during this trial, and he's the main witness that corroborates, for instance, that Troy Williams was more than merely present during any of these drug deals. Carl McAfee places him in a car sometimes, people place him present, but nobody has him handing kilos of cocaine such as Marcus Adams does. And Marcus Adams, what's particularly troubling about Marcus Adams is he himself expresses this concern that he has about a great switcheroo of identities.
And when did you get that evidence?
It came up at the sentencing hearing for Mr. Williams months after the trial.
Did the special assistant U.S. attorney try this case, or were there regular U.S. attorneys?
There were two, a special assistant United States attorney and a regular U.S. attorney. Also, during much of the testimony of Marcus Adams, for instance, when cross-examined by my co-counsel, Mr. Brennan, he's asked, did the government come out to see you this weekend? He says, no. And then he's reminded that there are documents that people have to sign when they go to visit people in corrections. All of a sudden, he starts to write, well, an agent and two U.S. attorneys, I think there were two, there's at least one, went up to visit him. It wasn't there just to have a chat with him. Much of this case that was actually presented, as opposed to what was initially investigated, apparently was developing in the week, in the first week of week before trial, in the first week of trial. And I don't think the government really had an opportunity to according to all the information they're getting, plea agreements from other states, they're getting all days into the trial. What did they know in order to sort it out and put the fairest and most accurate context in front of the jury. I think they discovered much of what was presented. They had this stuff about Big Cat Calhoun and these other people much earlier. They promised them the jury an opening statement, and then they never put them on. They said Agent Feinbeck was going to take the stand. They never put him on.
You finish your thought.
I think that goes with the confidence we can have in this verdict. I think that the government itself found much of this information very late for whatever reason. And I'm not.
I certainly call the jury's attention to the fact they didn't deliver on their promise.
We did in our closing argument, Your Honor. Yes. And some circuits have held that in itself. In and of itself is governmental misconduct. But I think the gist of it really is in the
context. You make a promise that you won't deliver on.
In opening statement.
It all depends.
Pardon?
It all depends. The general rule is the jury might lose confidence in the prosecutor, but it's grounds to the benefit ultimately of the defendant when he calls an attention. How can you believe him?
Except that given the jury instruction we were given here, if they found that the person had anything to do with the conspiracy without an individual weight, they may have very much, I don't believe it was the 5 kilos or even the 1 kilo, but he had something to do with it.
We're talking about undermining confidence in the jury and the prosecutor, not in the evidence itself.
One would hope a jury would take that into consideration.
One would hope, otherwise your argument would fall on deaf ears, and that's what you argued.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll concede that to a certain extent. Your Honor, there were many things.
I frankly always enjoyed it when my opponent failed to put out something he promised. He could play the violin for a long period after that.
We played the violin, Your Honor. That's true. There's no question we strummed the violin. But there were other things that were said in opening statement. For instance, early on in this case, my client was detained on the basis of a detainer for Mr. Knight and a man named Dirty Red, and my client's nickname was Red. It turns out later, we were given again shortly before trial, a document by the FBI that our client Red was not the Dirty Red, in fact, that was wanted in connection with this homicide. In opening statement, the government promised the jury that Margaret Frampton was going to say that a Red delivered these sales of cocaine. It turned out it was Reg, with a G as opposed to a D. But that's such a close...
And the jury's also instructed the remarks of counsel in either opening or closing or even during the argument in the trial are not to be considered evidence. It's simply arguments of counsel, and that's all that they've demonstrated to be wrong. That's the end of that.
That's
all
that. They are told that, and they were told that in this case.
Mr. Flynn, I realize that you said you're going to stand on the brief for the Williams brief, but will you now concede that United States versus Smith is dispositive of your argument regarding the validity of the indictment?
But for the fact, Your Honor, that mechanic, I think, applies to an untainted trial, and I think this trial was tainted. Other than that, I understand it is a ruling of a panel of the circuit, and this court is bound by.
I'm totally bound by it. We're not about to call the ink is still wet, Chase.
But on the other hand, I do believe this was a tainted trial because of the improper jury instruction and the Brady violation. The government in their reply brief pointed out that I hadn't investigated at certain points of the trial, which is true, but I worked at that time for the Federal Defender Services of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. That investigator was responsible not just for my case, but all the other cases in the office, and was not there all the time. And secondly, we're having a great deal of problems with the Milwaukee police officers who are flagrantly not obeying a federal subpoena to come to court, despite being given the date saying they're going to be there and not showing up. Destroying evidence in a homicide case that, according to all the policies, the detectives who testified said it should not have been destroyed, but said it was inadvertent. We had a lot of problems. A defense attorney should not be expected in a complex conspiracy where they're handed boxes of discovery about witnesses, half of whom are never called, and there's a great deal of interrelationship between these witnesses, to be handed new evidence almost on a daily basis, almost at every break, and then expected to run out and be able to respond to it. The government had years to investigate. This case goes back to 1996. Some of the stuff was just dribbling in after the trial. Witnesses were being interviewed the first day of trial, even the beginning of the second week of trial.
And who investigated? What agencies?
FBI. It was Keith Planbeck, and I believe he's in the transit. He was never called. And to his credit, honestly, at sentencing, when I asked who else, what do you know about it, he volunteered that this man, Orlando Williams, had said that Marcus Adams was there. Which is, if you read the Marcus Adams testimony, any defense attorney would have made heyday out of that. He's saying he's concerned somebody's going to put him there when he wasn't really there. I'd like to save whatever time I have left for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Crack?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Carol Kraft. I am Assistant United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I appear on behalf of the government here this morning. I am one of the trial attorneys who tried this case in the court below. As I indicated in my brief, I believe that the jury instructions that were given by the district court in this case to respond to counsel's first argument to the court were appropriate. I know that there is a split in the circuits at this point in terms of whether or not a more particularized, individualized instruction, as Mr. Flynn and his colleagues urged to the trial court, ought to be given to the jury. But the government submits that under the Supreme Court law as it exists at this point in time, and under the law that has been developed by this court relative to particularly conspiracy and appropriate jury instructions, the jury instruction that was given by the court was correct. The court gave the pattern instruction with a special verdict question asking whether the offense involved 5 kilograms or more of cocaine. And with respect to the substantive count as to which each Mr. Knight and Mr. Williams were charged, again, asked whether or not the offense involved 5 or more kilograms of cocaine. The substantive count asked each, and they were charged under not only Title 21, 841, and 846, but also Title 18, Subsection 2, the part of the crime statute, was possession with intent to distribute cocaine. And so under the instructions that the court gave to the jury was able to properly analyze whether as to, in the substantive offense, Mr. Knight and Mr. Williams were responsible for possessing with intent to distribute 5 kilograms or more of cocaine, and with respect to the conspiracy, whether or not each of the conspirators joined the conspiracy, and whether or not the conspiracy involved 5 or more kilograms of cocaine.
So there were 2 special verdicts, one as to the conspiracy, one as to each of the Williams and Knight.
That's correct, Your Honor. And, you know, I just also want to say that on the evidence that was presented in this case, it's preposterous to even imagine that a jury, if they hadn't been properly instructed, wouldn't have found the requisite amount. There were 144 kilograms of cocaine in the courtroom relative to the conspiracy that we had recovered during the course of this investigation and that were in the courtroom. There were photographs of, I believe, an additional 36. There were 44 kilograms that were recovered from the inside and around the Laura Collins home relative to the substantive count. Those were included in the 188. There were 44 from the California arrest and 144 from the California arrest and 44 from the Milwaukee arrest. So even under any stretch of imagination, if the jury had not been properly instructed, there's just no way that they couldn't and wouldn't have found that the defendants in this case were responsible for the requisite number of drugs, amount of drugs, and type of drug that triggers the 10 years to life penalty in this case.
Why was so much evidence produced during the trial rather than pre-trial?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Why was so much of the evidence produced during the trial rather than pre-trial?
Are you talking about those things that Mr.
Yes.
That counsel has complained about in their brief? Your Honor, it's our position that a number of those things were produced in a manner that perhaps might not have been as timely as we would have liked. But in reality, if the court looks at the record in the brief, over 4,000 pages of materials were produced to the defendants. They had the bulk of the evidence in this case. And when we look at
that's not the way we try. That's not our system of justice.
Well,
the bulk of, or 4,000 pages, if there were 40,000, we don't, you know, give them 4,000, even though 4,000 sounds pretty good.
Well, I think if I could answer the question this way, I think there are two things at issue here. One is whether or not they were denied exculpatory evidence, and the other is whether or not they were lately provided items that they were not necessarily entitled to have because they were not exculpatory and they were not in our open file. When we learned about them, we provided information that that they requested. And if I could just back up, the defendants have not established, I think, for any of the things that they complain about in their brief, that the evidence that they did not receive was helpful, suppressed, and material. They have, in all cases, they got this evidence prior to the time that the trial concluded, and I would submit with enough time to use that evidence. But some of the evidence that they complain about isn't even helpful to begin with, or at least was not viewed by us as helpful, but we got it when they requested it. For example, if I could just point out the plea agreement for Doris Outlaw. Doris Outlaw pled guilty to a drug count involving different actors, different offenses, different activity in Arkansas 2 years, 3 years before our case went to trial. I provided for them a copy of her judgment of conviction, which showed the sentence that she pled, the case that she pled guilty to, the sentence that she was exposed to, the crime that she pled guilty to, and the sentence that she got, and the case number. Now, it did not occur to me that her plea agreement in that case would have relevance to the case that was before our court. But when they asked me for it, which was the first day of trial, then I got it for them. Because it wasn't in my file. It wasn't that I kept it in my file and didn't disclose it to them. At no time during the time leading up to trial did any of them approach me and say, we have gone over the discovery material that you've provided. We think that we would like to have these additional items. We think that you have an obligation to provide them, or could you find out if they exist? Those requests came continually throughout the course of the trial.
And we don't have an open file policy, I think.
We do have an open file policy, but that means you get what's in my file. You get everything that I have. And if I haven't obtained an item because I'm not going to use it in my case, I don't believe it's exculpatory, and I don't think it has relevance to any particular thing that I'm going to show, then it's not in my file. I can't turn it over. But if you ask me for it, I'll get it for you, because I have nothing to hide. I want the defense to have all of the materials that are going to be helpful to them to go forward with the case, because I only want to do criminal cases one time. I don't want to have to try a case a second time. And I don't. It's not in the government's interest to hide even evidence that they don't believe it is exculpatory, let alone exculpatory evidence. And so the things that were turned over during the course of the trial that appeared to come late were turned over because that's when we got those things, or when we got the request for those things. Now, the one thing that I have to say that I'm very embarrassed about is the fingerprint report, because that was generated in May of 2001. The trial started in July of 2001. I didn't have it until the day that I gave it to defense counsel, and I should have, because I understand that there was some exculpatory value to that. However, they didn't do anything with it. They could have called the fingerprint examiner to testify that it wasn't Mr. Knight's, the one single fingerprint that actually was of poor quality that was found on one of the kilograms at Laura Collins' house was not Mr. Knight's and not Mr. Williams. It also wasn't Laura Collins or Orlando Williams, or I can't remember who else was excluded, but several people. They should have had that sooner. I agree with that, and I have a duty to find that kind of evidence sooner. But they didn't get it until it was too late to use it. They had 9 days to subpoena the fingerprint examiner to come and talk about that if they wanted to, and he never was called. Now, Mr. Finn talks about, they had trouble with the police department. Police officers declined to respond to federal subpoenas. There was one officer that he subpoenaed that didn't respond, and the judge let Mr. Flynn read in that officer's report. I see nothing else in the record, and I can tell the court that based on my presence at that trial, there were no other officers that declined or refused to cooperate with the defense, at least that were brought to the attention of the court. Now, I want to say something about Marcus Adams. Marcus Adams, unlike the cases that are cited in defendant's brief, the evidence in this case, the verdict in this case, did not turn on the credibility of one witness or two witnesses or even five witnesses. All of these witnesses had just a ton of baggage. And if the court reads their testimony, each of them was amply impeached with information that was provided by the government and or information that counsel found on their own. But there were 44 witnesses in this case. There was a wealth of documentary evidence. That's why we had hotel records. Marcus Adams isn't the person who puts Troy Williams at Laura Collins' house on the night of October 22nd. Actually, Laura Collins puts him there. Wisconsin hotel records put him there. Then we have testimony from William Worth, who is one of the couriers who is driving the trap cars, that he checked into the Akana Lodge in Milwaukee after making a trip here, and we have records from the Akana Lodge in Milwaukee that corroborate that he checked in on that very weekend, that Troy checked in, that Laura Collins says that Troy called her and said that he was coming with the drugs. There is a wealth of evidence in this case that creates the total product. It does not rest on the testimony of one person or two people. Yes, the testimony of individual people is important because it tells the story. But the reason that this case took 2 or 2.5 weeks to try is because it was very document intensive. We had motor vehicle records for the trap cars that were recovered from the home in California that William Worth said that he drove to Milwaukee, that are documented on hotel records. And then we have the registration documents that show that those vehicles were registered at various times in the name of William Worth, Doris Outlaw, William Worth, Doris Outlaw, James Durant, Willie Newton's brother, who testified for the government against all of the defense, a member of the conspiracy, resolved his case virtually on the eve of trial. The Tennessee plea agreement, that was part of a plea package that was being negotiated right before trial. The plea agreement wasn't in place yet, but I stood up in court and said, here's what we've negotiated, here's what it's going to include, and counsel hasn't shown that it was any different than what was represented, because of course it wasn't. The Tennessee plea agreement for James Durant was exactly what I represented it to be. I'm frustrated because there was just such a wealth of evidence in this case. And when I read the defense brief, I was like, oh my God, it looks like, you know, we just didn't turn over anything. And I tried to break it down in my brief to provide some kind of context as to what these things were, how it is that they were relevant, and when it is that they were provided, and whether or not they were material. And I think on balance, the defendants really had everything that they needed in order to defend this case.
See, I think the problem here is when you have so much evidence that gets produced during a trial rather than pre-trial, at some point that becomes so disruptive to the defense because of the drain on defense counsel's time and attention during a trial. We all know how nerve-wracking trials are. As to call into question the fairness of a trial, even if the individual items of evidence are not themselves critical to a case. So I guess what I'm saying is I understand both of your views of these terrible, huge mega trials. But of course, it's, you know, the government that chooses how to indict. But I understand, you know, your position as well.
What could be fairer?
Pardon?
What could be fairer? She understands both sides.
What could be fair? Yes, Doug, thank you for that fairness.
That's what we're all about. Hopefully.
I just want to say that, on balance, you know, the transcript reflects that this was a fair trial. And I wouldn't do it any other way with respect to the things that are not exculpatory. The only thing that I regret is the fact that that fingerprint report was not discovered and found sooner. But in terms of the other things, I have a continuing duty to disclose. And so when things become known to me, or if they ask me for them, I'm going to get them. And maybe they would have liked to have had them sooner, but you know, we also have a rule in our district where you're required to hold a discovery conference on disputed discovery issues with the parties are required to meet, the defense is required to meet with the government. And if anybody had said to me, you know, please, I've looked at the discovery, it occurs to me that this is missing, can you find it? I would have done it. You know, I was really offended in the brief where I am quoted as saying, and it's on page 14 of the defendant's consolidated brief. The government representative concluded that I have provided you with everything that I know of. I believe you have the right, you have everything that we have. And there's an ellipse in there, and what they've left out is, I don't know what else you think it is that's out there. If you can advise me specifically what it is, I will make an effort to see if there is anything else. And that was always my posture. It was my posture before trial. It was my posture during trial. And to say that the defense was surprised because they didn't get things that they would have liked to have had. But there is a difference between exculpatory things and things that they would like. And
you have an open file policy. How many exculpatory matters were delivered at trial?
The things that I think were exculpatory, I think the fingerprint report.
So that's the only item you would consider to be exculpatory that was delivered at trial or during trial.
Right. I could just flip through the things that they had.
You delivered other items because of your open file policy, but that's the only thing that was exculpatory.
Right. Physical evidence. The fire cartridges, you know, quite frankly, I would submit to you that those are really irrelevant. And the only reason that the crime lab analyst was being called that day was essentially to corroborate Laura Collins. If you recall the testimony, Laura Collins said that after she had delivered the kilogram of cocaine to Orlando Williams, she came back in the house, put the money on the table, Anthony Knight sitting at the table, Troy Williams is leaving for the liquor store, and she hears the front door being broken in. And then she and Anthony Knight run out the back door and start running in the alley. They hear shots. And she doesn't go back until much later. Anthony Knight leaves her and returns back to the house. A neighbor sees a man who looks, who matches his physical description, carrying items in and out, or carrying items out. And we learn later that those items are the cocaine that are recovered in the boxes in the alley behind her home. When the police come, they find her front door is broken open. They find casings in the front yard, and they find Frank McRae, who ultimately becomes the dead person, who, as all of the evidence suggests, was there with another person to commit a robbery. Could have been Orlando Williams. That's never been specifically determined, but it was moments after Orlando Williams leaves the house that in comes Frank McRae, or at least in comes the robbers, and it turns out to be Frank McRae. Now, the fact that the crime lab, does this mean that I'm running out of time?
That's your rebuttal. Or not rebuttal.
I don't get rebuttal
time. You have
a lot of time.
Okay.
How much time does she have? 3 minutes.
Okay. The fact that those casings are found there is only being introduced by me to show that the things that Laura Collins said really happened. Somebody broke in. There's a shootout in front of her house. And I didn't know until the Friday before he testified that there was another gun that had been sent out there 2 years after this happened, and they matched some of the casings to that gun. Some of the casings matched Frank McRae's gun, which showed that he was there essentially to rob that place, I think. It would have been nice to discover that sooner, but is it exculpatory? I don't think so. I think it's barely even relevant whose gun they came from. And the fact that this Danny Jones, who was arrested 2 years later on some other drug charge, had this gun, doesn't mean that he was there or even that he knew who was there that particular night. Or if he was, that he would admit that he was one of the people that came with Frank McRae to rob Laura Collins. And so much has been made of the fact that, you know, this came out at the last possible moment. It came out because, and if I can tell you, I called the crime lab person up and I said, you're going to testify on Monday and I have your report and here's what it said. And he said, well, did you know about this other thing? Well, not only did I not know, but the police department didn't know. Well, I call over to the police department and the homicide division doesn't have any information that this gun has been matched to the casings that are recovered at that house. Then they have to go and find for me, out of their microfiche library, the report of this Danny Jones' arrest, which I turn over on Monday morning when we get back to court. Now, is that lately provided? Yes. But was it provided when it first came to my attention? Yes. And should I have found it out about it sooner? I don't know. Is this exculpatory? I guess so. But I don't consider it to be exculpatory. I consider it to be tangential evidence that has little of any relevance to anything that happened.
Let me just briefly ask you about the use of the special assistant U.S. attorneys. Is your district use special assistance quite a bit?
Quite a bit. I think less now under the new U.S. attorney than under the prior U.S. attorney that we have.
Because we don't see them very often in any other, from any other district in the circuit.
Okay. And this is really outside of the record, but I think there was a grant for a firearms and drug initiative, and it was coordinated
who
with the
investigated state attorney. This case primarily? I know the defense counsel said FBI. Joint task force, or was it
investigation? It was kind of both. What happened is the night that the shooting occurred at Laura Collins' house, the Milwaukee Police Department responded, but the FBI responded too because it was such a large amount of drugs. 44 kilograms of drugs at that time was a large amount of drugs in our cocaine in our district. Unfortunately, there's been more since, but at that time it was so everybody responded at that point in time. The case was, in terms of the homicide portion of this, was investigated by the police department, and accordingly, our case relied on some of the evidence that they had collected and some of the things that they had done. The person responsible, the agency responsible for investigating the federal component of this was the FBI. Now, both of the defendants were fugitives, or two of the defendants, Mr. Newton was not, but Mr. Newton was not known originally when this became first to the attention of authorities. Mr. Knight and Mr. Williams were fugitives for several years, until 2000. The substantive offense happened in 1996, 4 years. They were fugitives before they were finally located and brought back. And so some of the evidence that was gathered by the FBI through other agencies like the Arizona police agency that had investigated.
Multi-agencies involved.
Margaret Frampton, right. And so some of it was evidence that had already been collected and then was located by the FBI agent and pulled together for our use. And some of it was stuff that he had generated in his investigation, and some of it was from the Milwaukee Police Department.
Thank you, Mr. Kraft.
Okay, my time is up. Thank you very much.
How much time, Mr. Fleming? You have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Just briefly, I want to touch on a few points in response to some of the comments made by the prosecutor. In the first place, I did specifically request those items, such as plea agreements, criminal reports, as to each testifying defendant, and I did so by filing a motion some 4 months before the trial. And I was actually at the time ridiculed for doing it because I was told that the open file policy in Milwaukee is so generous that there's no need to do that. I specifically itemized every item that subsequently started popping up and categorized them and asked them for any witness that was going to be testifying. Secondly, this is about being a fugitive. Mr. Williams was a resident of California during part of his time, but he was not charged and then fled the jurisdiction. I believe Mr. Knight was in a California prison during much of this time, so they were not in the jurisdiction, but I don't want the court to be left with the impression they were indicted, brought into court, and then fled. In terms of the Brady violations, and I understand that it's difficult sometimes for a prosecutor to make a decision whether they think something is not exculpatory. That's why we have defense attorneys. It's difficult sometimes for a defense attorney to see always what is inculpatory about what the government is requesting be introduced. But I will say at a minimum that a statement by Orlando Williams, who was arrested and tried and convicted in Eastern District of Wisconsin, and his case ultimately went into the courts, that Marcus Adams was present the night of October 22nd, 1996, when 44 kilograms were found around the Collins house, and a dead body was found, and tens of thousands of dollars of cash, is exculpatory. It's directly contradicting to what he testified at trial. It wasn't provided until sentencing after the trial.
Jimmy McAfee, the cousin, and by the way, the government has said that, yes.
We were maintaining a record. We're trying to record what you say for posterity and for review later, so we stick around in front of the desk, we'll be able to hear it.
I'm sorry, yeah. Yes, 144 kilos were placed on the table. That's a large quantity of cocaine. No one's trying to. The issue becomes, what is each individual responsible for? And the fact that somebody else's fingerprint is on those 144 kilos other than Mr. Knight or Mr. Williams or Mr. Newton is incredibly important. That somebody else knew that cocaine was there and touched it that night. the fact that the shell casings are there, especially if you had it in conjunction with a statement that was gotten much previous that Marcus Adams was there, would lead to all types of investigations. We wouldn't be looking for a man named Danny Knight. The police department had this for months. Jimmy McAfee, I mean, provided cast aspersions on the credibility of some of the other. He didn't come to our sentencing argument. The obvious conclusion we drew was that he was casting aspersions on Marcus Adams. He denied it. But had we known Marcus Adams was there that night, this could have led to all types. I mean, you can't investigate these things 3 days into the trial. You're getting, and we didn't even get the Marcus Adams stuff until sentencing. That's huge, because Marcus Adams testified he was concerned about a big switcheroo of identities. Voluntarily, nobody put that question to him. He just pulled that out of thin air, which I think is almost equivalent to, you know, denying culpability in a way that when you're not being asked that is very suspicious, certainly would have led to all kinds of questions on my part. Any one of these people, the government has selected the California people as being the suppliers of this drug, but William Worth did not identify my client, Troy Williams, out in California. The landlord out in California said he saw people that routinely, where the cocaine was, the check was, said he never saw my client. William Worth, in court, got up and picked another man out of a photo array in front of the jury and identified him as a Tony, not my client. And when asked, was he sure, said yes. This is not this kind of ironclad. Yes, if you pick and choose what they said on one occasion and ignore what they said on another occasion, you can fashion this government's theory that as to each defendant is more than 5 kilos. But that's not what a jury does, and it invades the province of the jury for us to do it, for this court to do it, for the trial court to do it, for the government to do it. They were never instructed that they had to find, as to each defendant, the requisite quantity, and I think that's a fatal flaw. And I respectfully request that this court return this for a new trial. These men are all doing a mandatory life sentence on the basis of this jury instruction. And after death, it's about as bad as it gets. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Glenn, you said you're no longer with the federal...
I'm with the Federal Defendant Program for the Northern District of Illinois now, out in Rockford. They just opened the Western Division. So I think I sent in my change of address and everything.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.